This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Earlier this month, March 6th, Fox News host Tucker Carlson went to air with an exclusive. He'd been given unfettered access to 42,000 hours of Capitol footage from the January 6th, 2021 attack on Congress.
Our producers were given use of Capitol computers with advanced mapping software. That made it easy to find what we were looking for.
Carlson and Fox News were looking for a narrative to placate and pander to their audience, to distract from the truth that rioters stormed the Capitol and violently halted the electoral count and disrupted American democracy, the truth that rioters attacked and injured Capitol Police, that they surged together to break down doors and windows, that some roamed the halls of Congress searching for lawmakers while wearing body armor, carrying zip ties, or parading the Confederate flag. Instead, Tucker Carlson and Fox News were looking for a way to whitewash history.
The crowd was enormous. A small percentage of them were hooligans. They committed vandalism. You've seen their pictures again and again. But the overwhelming majority weren't. They were peaceful. They were orderly and meek. These were not insurrectionists. They were sightseers.
Tucker Carlson, on Fox News, March 6th of this year. So, orderly, meek, sightseers. Wonder what the January 2021 version of Congressman Kevin McCarthy would think of that.
People brought ropes. When I got back into my building, I found the straps that they had. I don't know, they're coming to try to kidnap somebody or whatever, but they were well planned for it.
This is Kevin McCarthy in January of 2021, just days after the attack on Congress. He was speaking on KERN News Talk Radio, a local California station that airs in his Bakersfield district. And on that day, McCarthy said, quote, "What the mob did was un-American.
What happened in this Capitol should never happen again. Anybody that participated needs to go to court, needs to go to jail. We have been clear about that from day one."
Well, 2 years later, it was none other than Kevin McCarthy, now House Speaker and second in line for the presidency, who gave Tucker Carlson unprecedented and unfettered access to the Capitol footage so that Carlson could spin the tale of a meek and orderly mob.
Thanks to the new Republican Speaker's office, we gained access to thousands of hours of surveillance video that help answer that question.
Well, here's another question. Why? Why would the current Speaker of the House, the same man who desperately called Donald Trump on January 6th, 2021, begging Trump to call off the rioters, why would he give an exclusive to a network known to lie about January 6th and to lie about the results of the 2020 presidential election itself? Why are some of his other colleagues in the Republican caucus visiting accused and convicted rioters in a DC jail, high-fiving them, and dubbing their cells the Patriot Wing? What does this say about the health and fragility of American democracy right now, when elected congressional leaders are throwing their vocal support behind people both accused and convicted of one of the most violent attacks on U.S. government in the nation's history? And they're doing so even as hundreds and hundreds of January 6th trials are still moving through the justice system. Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. And we'll start with Ryan Riley. He's a justice reporter at NBC News, and he has been thoroughly covering January 6th and its aftermath and all of those hundreds of cases. He's author of Sedition Hunters, How January 6th Broke the Justice System. Ryan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us today is Tim Hafey. He's a former U.S. attorney who served as chief investigative counsel for the House January 6th committee. And he joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Tim Hafey, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna.
Well, Tim, I wonder if I could just start with you. When you first heard about Speaker McCarthy giving those hours of footage to Tucker Carlson and then subsequently saw Carlson's report in early March, what did you think? What was your reaction?
Well, my first reaction was surprise at his access. when the committee worked with the Capitol Police to get access to that footage, it was under very strict controls. This is really sensitive information. You know, the Capitol complex has cameras throughout, inside and out. And the specific locations of those cameras is something that the Capitol Police holds very close. They don't want the public knowing exactly the vantage points from which they observe events. And they certainly don't want the public to know about routes of evacuation and safe spaces within the complex that were utilized on January 6th. So before we could use any of that footage publicly, we had a very careful process with the Capitol Police, consulting with them before we disclosed any of those locations through the use of footage in our hearings. I don't know if Tucker Carlson had any such agreement, if the speaker put any restrictions on the access to footage or subsequent use of it. So my first reaction, Meghna, was alarm that this really sensitive law enforcement information was provided to an outside source without those protections.
Well, I understand that without elaborating, Steve Scalise said at one point in time that what gets released is going to be, quote unquote, scrutinized. But there wasn't any elaboration on that. So then based on what you saw, though, in terms of the footage that Carlson eventually put on the air, Tim, I mean, how much does that differ from, you know, the analysis that you came away with doing your work for the January 6th committee?
It differs radically. This narrative that there were a lot of peaceful protesters or sightseers at the Capitol is absolute hogwash. You know, this was an insurrection. This was a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol. Over 1,000 people have been arrested, not all of them arrested for committing property destruction or assault on law enforcement, but every single person who streamed through the broken windows and doors of the Capitol knew that they were trespassing, knew that they were committing a crime. And the notion that this was some sort of lark or some sort of peaceful, happy-go-lucky protest is just false. And he took selective bits of footage of people walking around the Capitol and is using that to create this misleading narrative that that somehow this was a peaceful protest.
Well, I suppose that Carlson and maybe even some Fox viewers would levy that same accusation against the January 6th committee. In fact, that's some of the response that we were hearing as the committee was presenting its public finding in those hearings, that there was cherry picking going on. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, again, it was important to us that we put everything that we found forth to the public. So we didn't just write a report, an 845-page report. We released the entirety of the body of work, all of the transcripts of all of the interviews, all of the documents that are cited in the report. It was important for us, Meghna, to make sure that we could not be accused of sort of cherry-picking findings, presenting some and not others. And that's why, in addition to the sort of a sum of the equation at the end, this was a multi-part plan by the president and his allies to subvert the transfer of power. We wanted the raw material, the worksheet of sorts, to be released as well so that people could make their own judgment. They could read all that material, review it, and determine for themselves if our conclusions were misleading or are accurate. And I'm proud of them and stand behind them. I think they're exactly accurate.
So, Ryan, I'm going to come to you in a second, but Tim, do you think that this kind of alternative narrative now that's being spun, I'll go so far as to say with the assistance of the House Speaker, since he decided to give the footage to Fox, but this alternative narrative, is it damaging to the American people or to our understanding of what actually happened on January 6th?
Sure. I think anytime there's a misleading narrative that's put forth trying to sort of recreate what really happened, it is damaging. The mandate of the Select Committee was to tell a truthful, credible story as to what happened and to learn from it, right? And to make recommendations and suggest process improvements that will make this less likely to happen in the future. So we have to start with truth. We have to start with facts. We have to start with an honest reckoning of what happened. And a dishonest reckoning of what happened is inconsistent with that process.
Okay. Ryan Riley with NBC News, appreciate your patience here. You have been covering many of the criminal cases regarding January 6th that are working their way through the justice system. Do you think that the release of this footage and how it's being repackaged by Fox News is going to have any impact on the cases that are still currently pending?
You know, I don't think it'll have any material impact on a lot of the cases. I think it will certainly get a lot of things sort of off track because you already see a number of defendants pointing to this and saying that they think this somehow changes the merits of their cases. You know, there is one defendant who is actually on trial the week that a lot of this came out, and Online Sleuths had referred to her as window watcher because, you know, she sort of has this these wild-eyed photos, and she films some selfie videos when she was inside one of the rooms on the Western Terrace right beside the tunnel. She was inside the tunnel first, and then she went through a broken window and was filming through there as rioters tried to create another entry point and actually stacked a table where they expected the police would come in. This was another potential battle line that was drawn when they actually breached the actual Capitol building. And, you know, she thought that this Tucker footage was going to just be was going to be it for her. She actually, you know, went after she was convicted on all of the counts she was charged with. You know, she had taken the stand and testified to the fact that she actually went inside the Capitol and said that she had the right to do so, and had sort of all these sort of wild conspiracy theories that she was articulating on the stand. And then afterwards, when she was convicted, went on Facebook Live or her husband's Facebook Live account and said, you know, keep watching Tucker. I have a feeling this is all going to fall apart. So, you know, she's one of these people who think who Tucker's giving a lot of false hope because she thinks that she's going to be out of it because of the footage that he aired. And that's just not the reality. You know, she's going to be sentenced and it's probably going to be end up doing some significant time in federal prison because of the approach that she chose to take to this.
Well, Ryan Riley joins us today. He's justice reporter with NBC News, and Tim Hafey is also with us. He served as chief investigative counsel on the January 6th committee. And we'll talk a lot more about how certain members of Congress have been showing vocal support for the accused and convicted from January 6th and what that means for our democracy. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about how several key members of Congress in the Republican caucus are vocally showing their support and throwing their support behind defendants, those charged and accused and convicted in the January 6th attack against the Capitol, and really what that says about our democracy right now. I'm joined today by Tim Hafey. He served as chief investigative counsel on the January 6th Congressional Committee. Ryan Riley joins us as well. He's justice reporter at NBC News. And we had been talking about the decision that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy made earlier this year to give unfettered access to Capitol footage or of Capitol footage to Fox News. And Speaker McCarthy was asked about why he did that. He was asked by reporters in the halls of Congress. And here is how McCarthy responded.
So if I'm exclusive, then I'll give it out to the entire country. Because I think sunshine matters, so I don't care what side of the issue you are on.
So you heard McCarthy there saying that Fox has an exclusive, and then he's going to give it out to the entire country. What he also said in that same sort of hallway walk and talk is he did a little bit of whataboutism and turned the attention to his concerns about CNN supposedly showing exit routes when they have footage. He's concerned, he said, about Nancy Pelosi's daughter showing whether members of Congress went to Fort McNair when they weren't supposed to say they were there. There's a documentary that CNN put out, and he The speaker insisted that we won't play politics like that, end quote. Tim Hafey, just respond to that really quickly.
Yeah, look, Magna, anytime this footage is aired by any source, it creates potential issues for law enforcement. It really needs to be judiciously and carefully used. There were times when we asked the Capitol Police about using a particular clip of footage, and they said, well, can you zoom here so the specific corridor isn't obvious? Or can you stop it here because when he turns this corner, it's obvious where he is? And we generally accommodated that. Again, there's a balance here between a truthful account of what happened and the protection of the complex going forward. And we tried very hard to sort of accommodate those concerns while doing our job in telling the truth. Again, the problem here is that I just don't know that any such accommodation process is going on with Tucker Carlson or Fox or with any other outlet. And that is troubling. The Capitol Police chief has said the same thing. He is also very concerned and learned about this disclosure on the news, was not given advance notice. And again, law enforcement ought to be involved in this discussion and actually helping identify security risks for the use of any of this footage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we want to try and start pulling together the different members of Congress and their the way they've been showing support for January 6th defendants. So let's put the House Speaker aside for just a moment and turn our attention to Republican Representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who visited January 6th defendants at the jail they're being held in Washington, D.C. She visited on Friday. And here she is speaking to reporters outside the jail as protesters blew whistles in the background.
There were many, many reports of how they're being abused and how their rights are being abused. And remember, these are pre-trial January 6th defendants. The reason why we're here is because the two-tier justice system has to end.
Ryan Riley, do you understand what she's saying about, quote-unquote, reports about how these defendants are being abused or how their rights are being abused?
I mean, I think they're just complaining about jail, I think is like the overall takeaway here, right? Like, the conditions that they've been given in some ways are better than most of your pretrial detainees across the country. And of course, those who are being held pretrial, we should say, first of all, that some of the people who are being held in that jail have actually been convicted of the crimes that they've been charged with. Others, there's just overwhelming evidence of their guilt, but they haven't formally been declared guilty yet. They haven't gone through that process, but a judge in every one of those cases, sometimes a federal magistrate judge, sometimes a U.S. A district judge, sometimes an appellate court on appeal has decided that their detention is warranted based on the overwhelming evidence against them, as well as the threat that they pose to the community or the possibility that they could flee. So there's, you know, an analysis that's been done and argued in court in all of these cases. And, you know, the people who are being held there are charged overwhelmingly with violent crimes. I think there's one individual who's only facing misdemeanor charges. And, you know, you look into his case a little bit, and the reason that he is being held pretrial is because, well, A, he brought he has a hammer on his belt when he came to the Capitol. But the more relevant factor being here is that they tried to serve a grand jury subpoena on him. He refused service of it. They tried to arrest him with a California Highway Patrol and pulled him over on the side of the road, at which point he fled the stop. And then he holed up in his apartment complex or in his condo when the FBI came to arrest him and engaged in a standoff for several hours with the FBI. So that seems like a kind of case where, you know, it might be warranted to hold someone pretrial, given demonstration that they've given that they can't be are going to cooperate with the court system and are a danger to the community. So, you know, these cases really have been adjudicated. And there's a reason that I think, you know, your Marjorie Taylor Greens don't want to go into any detail about these individual cases and prefer to speak very broadly and not actually get into the weeds, because the facts of the matter don't look good for them, right? They don't mm-hmm. want to talk about what these individuals are actually charged with, why they're being held. They just rather make it as though, you know, a bunch of grannies who held picket signs are being held behind bars right now, rather than actually talk about the facts and the details of these cases.
So, Tim Hafey, given what Ryan just described, it kind of puts what Representative Green has said about the January 6th defendants being held in that jail in a new light, because she even calls like the cells that they're held in the quote-unquote Patriot Wing, Patriot's Wing, and supposedly high-fived some of the defendants as well. I mean, do you see this? I mean, you were also a former U.S. attorney, Tim. So do you see this as a meddling of politics in the justice system?
Look, I was a prosecutor in Washington, D.C., so I know exactly the facility in which these folks are held. First of all, this isn't the D.C. jail. This is the correctional treatment facility, which is right next to the jail, right? So it's already a step above in terms of the accommodations for prisoners. It's actually meant to be a medical facility. They're also segregated in a wing together. They're not in general population. I think that's for their own protection. They're given access to news coverage, to iPads, actually. Look, jail is hard. Their liberty is restrained. But the conditions under which these Jan 6 pretrial detainees are being held is frankly better than the average prisoner who's held pending trial in D.C. And of course, we heard nothing about that for years and years from Marjorie Taylor Greene or anyone else, the conditions under which black and brown people who are charged with other offenses in Washington, D.C. are held pending trial. So it is an attempt for her and others like her to use some sort of political narrative into a situation without justification.
Now, Ryan, you know, earlier I'd mentioned that there are hundreds and hundreds of cases still pending. It suddenly occurs to me that I may have lowballed it. I mean, where are we with the trials?
That's right. So 1,000 cases have been brought forward thus far. But I think, you know, if you put that on the scale of things, the total number of people who could be charged because they either entered the Capitol or because they assaulted members of law enforcement outside is in excess of 3,000. Now, the Justice Department isn't going to be able to get to that full number realistically before the statute of limitations expires. But what they have told the court is that there could be another 1,000 cases in the pipeline, which would bring us to 2,000. And, you know, this really has overwhelmed the court system in a lot of ways. They're not used to processing this many cases. And, you know, it's impossible to even cover all of these trials that are ongoing. There's ones going on right inside right now. You know, I've at many times been the only person in the courtroom gallery for a lot of these cases as they make their way through the system. Right now, there's a huge seditious conspiracy trial unfolding involving involving members of the Proud Boys. And there's these other bench trials that are being held, jury trials that are being held on a regular basis. But it really is, you know, a lot for the court system to handle, especially considering that we're just coming out of COVID. So, you know, the courtroom was essentially shut down for that first year plus of after the January 6th attack. So that has really held up a lot of these cases. There were cases that were waiting to go to jury trial before January 6th that have nothing to do with the attack. So it really is overwhelming the court system in a lot of ways. And, you know, there are a ton of individuals who are just basically waiting to be arrested, including people who have been identified by online sleuths for a very long time. The list of people who have been ID'd is, you know, who have not yet been arrested is around 1,000. So those are just the ones that that the online sleuths know of. You know, the FBI still probably has others that the online sleuths don't. So it's going to be a long time ahead. And, you know, as we see these conspiracy theories pick up, it's always really interesting to look because, you know, they'll focus in on someone and say, hey, this is Antifa. And in reality, it's like, you know, I'll pull up his Facebook page and, you know, I don't know, MAGA forever sounds pretty supportive of Donald Trump for someone that they accuse of being Antifa. So a lot of these cases, you know, it's going to take a while. And that's unfortunately the situation that we're in, where a lot of this disinfo is out there, even though, you know, a lot of these arrests are still in the pipeline. And, you know, the overwhelming majority of people who were there, in fact, pretty much everyone who was there in support of Donald Trump and committed violence on his behalf.
Well, Ryan Riley, justice reporter for NBC News. Ryan, thank you, as always, for coming back to the show.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so Tim Hafey, hang on here for just a minute, because I want to bring Noah Bookbinder into the conversation now. He's president of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Noah, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
Okay, so let's take the word ethics first. Do you have ethical concerns about the actions that the members of Congress we've been discussing so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see that on a couple of different levels. First of all, just in terms of kind of the sense of ethics that all of us have, you know, members of Congress are expected to represent the American people. They're expected to look out for our system of our democratic system of government. And after January 6, 2021, there really was this opportunity for members of Congress across the political spectrum to come together and condemn what was truly an attack on our democracy, because they were there. They saw how horrific it was. They were worried for their own lives. And instead, what you've seen is members of Congress like Marjorie Taylor Greene, but also Speaker McCarthy, concluding that it was in their political interest to essentially downplay what happened on January 6th and make excuses for the people who attacked them. And, you know, that is members of Congress themselves undermining the democracy that they are supposed to be representing. And there are real ethical problems with that. But more specifically, looking at you know, the rules that apply to members of Congress, and you know, there aren't kind of specific rules that say you can't go to DC jail and mm-hmm. Associate with charged insurrectionists. But the rules do say that members of Congress are expected to behave in a way that reflects creditably on the House of Representatives. And, you know, when you have them going in and kind of throwing in their lot with the people who attacked the Capitol, attacked law enforcement, sought to overturn a free and fair election, surely, if anything does not reflect creditably on the institution of Congress, it would be that.
But the reflection as seen by whom, though, right? Because I imagine that these same members of Congress would say that the constituents they speak with or that they represent are very supportive of their efforts to, you know, to throw their weight behind the January 6th defendants.
I mean, look, you know, that's presumably why these members of Congress are doing what they're doing. They know who their base is, and they are appealing to those people. You know, look, I think we all need to have to try to understand why people got to a place of attempting to overturn an election and to bring violence to the U.S. Capitol. But what we can't be doing is throwing away – what members of Congress can't be doing is throwing away their commitment to elections that count, to a system of checks and balances. And, you know, they need to ultimately – stand with and stand for that institution. And, you know, one thing that we have seen, if you look back historically, is that when there are violent overthrows of democratic systems or you know, installation of authoritarian forms of government, it rarely happens on the first try. Often what happens is that there's a failed attempt, and then rather than condemnation, you have mythologizing and whitewashing of that, and that lays the groundwork for future attempts. And you know, that's the really dangerous ground we're treading here. When you have, you know, Donald Trump, the person who incited that insurrection, running for president again, ramping up his violent rhetoric, and these members of Congress are sort of doing their part to potentially lay the groundwork for more anti-democratic attacks, more violence in the future. And that is it's an ethics problem. It's a democracy problem.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hafey, did you have a response to that?
I agree with what Noah is saying. And look, Meghna, let's not forget that members of Congress were directly and personally involved in what I've called sort of the white-collar aspect of January 6th, the political machinations to try to prevent the transfer of power. Members of Congress mm-hmm. who tried to orchestrate personnel change at the Department of Justice and the installation of an acting attorney general who would take action without basis in fact or law. Members of Congress who facilitated and directly put pressure on state officials to hold special sessions or to put forth fake slates of electors for President Trump, despite the results of the election in those states. So our report details members of Congress that were part of this plot, who actively themselves worked with the president and his co-conspirators to prevent the transfer of power. And if we're going to talk about ethics, it's one thing to sort of stand in front of the correctional treatment facility and say these are political prisoners. It's another thing entirely to actively participate in a plot to prevent the transfer of power. And I think our report does a good job of laying that out. And talk about an ethical violation, it's there in spades in the white-collar part of the case.
Well, Tim Hafey and Noah Bookbinder, hang on for just a minute. We'll talk a lot more about what the implications are of all of this for the continued fragility of American democracy when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Tim Hafey joins us today. He served as chief investigative counsel on the January 6th Congressional Committee. Noah Bookbinder joins us as well. He's president of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And we're getting a lot of comments coming in from listeners online here. On Twitter, one listener says, Kevin McCarthy's GOP is sending out a loud message. The GOP is the party that will support insurrectionists and anybody who commits crimes on behalf of Donald Trump. This makes the GOP a national security threat, not an American political party. That's from a listener on Twitter. Another listener says, the only relevant question is the one you asked at the top of the hour. Why? What is their motivation and what is the end game? Well, we talked about House Speaker McCarthy. We've talked a little bit about Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Let's now bring in Donald Trump, because to kick off his first official campaign rally in Waco, Texas, which took place on Saturday, Donald Trump played Justice for All. Now, this is a song featuring a group called the J6 Prison Choir, and they're singing the Star Spangled Banner while Trump recites the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, the J6 Prison Choir is a group of January 6th defendants currently being held in Washington, D.C. And here's a clip from that song, which once again played at the start of Trump's rally in Waco on Saturday.
Indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And at the rally, as the song was played, Trump held his hand over his heart. And in the backdrop behind him, there were photos of some of the rioters from January 6th. Well, at the same rally in Waco, a little bit later, Trump talked about the defendants, again, the ones that are currently being held in D.C. And here's what he said.
But under Joe Biden, American patriots are being arrested and held in captivity like animals. Look at what's happening in Washington. And I will tell you, Marjorie Taylor Greene is the expert. She's been to that prison many times. There is nobody that has described what's happening in that prison. It's a hellhole. And these are soldiers and policemen and firemen and medics and doctors in a couple of cases. These are people that shouldn't have been there. And when you look at the Tucker Carlson tapes from 2 weeks ago and you see so many things that turned out to be false, very important what Tucker's done, what Sean has done, what Laura did. Laura did a piece last night that was incredible.
Donald Trump there on Saturday in Waco, Texas, at the end of that clip he mentioned, not just Tucker Carlson, but Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, also from Fox News. So here we now have Donald Trump, who can actually brings together all of these threads we've been discussing this hour. House Speaker McCarthy's decision to release those tapes to Fox News. Marjorie Taylor Greene showing her support for the January 6th defendants. And now Donald Trump himself. So Jack Beatty joins us. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So what do you see in this coming together of these threads in what Donald Trump just said there?
Well, the threads are very intimate for Mr. Trump. He has said, quote, "I'm looking seriously at full pardons and apologies for the rioters, the insurrectionists." And he's also said he's financially supporting some of them. So he appears to be in business with them in terms of selling that recording or that video, whatever it is that he's made. And he bragged last night with Sean Hannity that he's a regular Elvis. They're selling so many people are getting so many listens to that music. He's also using the January 6th. Rioters as a sort of paradigm, as a kind of threat, and he did it last week when he was asked about when he was talking about Alvin Bragg and the imminent, as he thought, indictment. His imminent indictment. He said there will be death and destruction following any indictment of me. Well, last night on Hannity said, "Well, what about that death and destruction? That seems a little, a little extreme." And here's what Trump said: "I didn't say do something bad. I said I'm afraid that people will do something because they're very upset about it." So it's not incitement. I didn't tell them to do that. It is protected speech. The First Amendment, according to the Supreme Court and the Brandenburg decision, protects even speech that recommends criminal acts if there is no direction, go and do death and destruction, and if the death and destruction is not imminent. You can advocate unlawful acts, as he did. So he remains what Judge Luttig in the hearings called a threat, a clear and present danger to our democracy. And he invokes the January 6th paradigm as, look, I can get rioters out on the street. But there's something else he's doing. This is new territory, I think. And it's, in a way, even more insidious. He is threatening individuals, not just the system now. He's putting targets on people's backs. When he calls when he says Mitch McConnell has a death wish for going along with a spending bill, when he calls Alvin Bragg human scum and a degenerate psychopath, what he's doing there is practicing what scholars call stochastic terrorism. That's quite a mouthful. But basically, here's the definition: the public demonization of a person or group resulting in the incitement of a violent act, which is statistically probable, but whose specifics cannot be predicted. He's essentially invoking a threat that may come out to individuals. And there are so many people out there, there are millions of people, somebody among them is bound to act on it. And of course, studies of this have shown that people on militia sites who were searching for militia groups, they also, by over 100%, more likely also to search for mental health information. In other words, there's a large percentage of people who can be activated to violent acts. And already the system is reacting to this. The judge in the federal judge in the Jean Carroll rape and defamation trial, which is going to begin in April 25th in New York, he has ruled that his jurors must be anonymous, that no information about them can come out. And he cited Trump's threats precisely. So Trump has moved from brandishing January 6th as, a, you know, we'll have riots in the street, to putting targets on the backs of individuals.
Right. From it will be wild to there will be death and destruction. Right. So Noah, I mean, Jack gave us a lot to think about there. I'm just wondering, so what do you take away from his analysis?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right that, you know, Donald Trump has gotten where he's gotten with the politics of grievance, the sense that he and his supporters have been you know, treated unfairly. And he has also again and again sought to, you know, when he loses, to not recognize the defeat, when he's looking at prosecution to undermine the legitimacy of that and, you know, and to encourage a kind of vilification of those who seek to bring about any kind of accountability for him. And what you have here is rather than the rest of his party, of the Republican Party, kind of cutting ties and saying we've seen where this can lead, instead they are realizing that or they are making the calculation that their political fortune lies with taking Donald Trump's side and, you know, kind of twisting reality to kind of go along with the way he's portraying things. So you have, you know, Kevin McCarthy in the House creating this committee that is called the subcommittee to examine weaponization, and you know, Donald Trump, of course, for 4 years really did weaponize government. He really used the Justice Department to try to protect himself and his allies, and in some cases, go after perceived enemies. But you've got this committee being formed not to go after that, not to look into that, but rather. To investigate those who have investigated January 6th, those who have investigated Donald Trump. You know, that's, you know, my organization crew sent a letter to Jim Jordan, who's in Congress, who is running that committee, and saying, hey, if you're going to have a weaponization committee, you should be studying the actual weaponization of government. But instead, we have this altering of reality and this kind of complicity at the highest levels of Congress that is really laying the groundwork, sort of adding a sense of approval for this growing violent rhetoric and the possibility that, you know, we can see events like January 6th or like the kind of targeted violence that we're just talking about coming in the future. And that's really, really distressing.
So, Tim Hafey, let me come to you because Noah is exactly right in mentioning some of these other, you know, committees right now that the Republican-led House is forming. And it leads me again to the question of, like, why? What is the end game here? Another one of them is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a different committee that's supposed to be investigating or an investigation into the January 6th Congressional Committee, again, that you did work for, Tim. And this investigation from the Republican-led House is being led by Georgia Republican Barry Loudermilk, which is notable because last year through the January 6th committee, we found out that the day before the riots, Loudermilk was leading a group of folks through the halls of Congress, giving a tour at a time where virtually no one was allowed to do that. So, Tim, can you talk about that for just a quick minute?
Yeah, sure, Meghna. So I do understand from public reports that Representative Loudermilk is going to lead a six-person committee, subcommittee, to investigate the investigators. Candidly, that's something that we always expected. And from the very beginning, we were mindful that everything that we did on the select committee would be picked apart for years and years, and sort of welcomed that. It's part of why, going back to what I said before, we put all of the information that we gathered out on the public record so that we couldn't be accused of cherry picking the good stuff or the bad stuff. The interesting thing about Representative Loudermilk, as you said, you know, we one of the things we investigated was whether or not members of Congress were giving tours to people who ended up at the Capitol on January 6th in the days before. And that surveillance footage that we talked about earlier was useful. We had all of the surveillance footage. And we found Representative Loudermilk himself with a group of people, and it was unclear to us who they were, literally walking through the halls of the House office buildings. You know, to be clear, he didn't lead that group to the Capitol building, but he led them through halls of, I believe, the Rayburn House office building. And one of the individuals was taking photographs of stairwells, of placards on doors, not the type of things that normally a tourist would be interested in photographing. And that individual who was snapping pictures was someone who was at the Capitol the next day. We wrote a letter to Representative Loudermilk and asked him for information about the circumstances that gave rise to that group, him leading that group through. And he refused to come in and talk with us. So he was a sort of a witness, an important potential witness in our case. And now he's being asked, despite his lack of cooperation with our process, to lead an investigation of the investigation. Which, you know, again, I find curious. If I could, I just wanted to go back quickly, though, to the discussion about what President Trump has recently said.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
I'll leave it to Noah and to Jack to talk about the politics of that. That's really not my area of expertise. But it does bear upon a crucial issue in the criminal investigation. Right? The special counsel is really laser focused on evidence of President Trump's intent. The statute, the lead statute that our committee recommended as a possible criminal charge, is obstruction of an official proceeding. And that requires a criminal prosecutor to provide evidence that that President Trump corruptly intended to disrupt an official proceeding. He specifically intended to obstruct, interfere with, or impede the joint session. Our report lays out lots of evidence that is a manifestation of his intent to obstruct that official proceeding. All of the prongs of the sort of white-collar parts of the effort to prevent the transfer of power, the submission of fake electors, the pressure on the Justice Department, the pressure on the vice president and state officials, his actions on January 6th, his incendiary rhetoric at the Ellipse, his desire to go to the Capitol during the march that he called for from that podium, and then his inaction over the course of the riot, despite being repeatedly implored to call off the rioters. When I hear him continue to praise the actions of these patriots, calling the incarcerated men at the DC jail patriots, it seems to me like additional evidence of praising their conduct, of his intent, right, of his desire that they succeed in that protest in disrupting the official proceeding. So the more he talks, the more the special counsel pays attention. It's very mm-hmm. difficult to look into someone's mind and derive evidence of specific intent.
Yeah.
But public statements praising rioters as calling them patriots, despite the fact that they're charged with violence, yep. pretty indicative of his specific intent.
Well, Tim Hafey, Noah Bookbinder, and Jack Beatty, thank you to all three of you. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is On Point.